Hello, thank you for listening to episode 4 of 60 Minutes With. I'm Dave, and in this episode I'm going to be talking to a guy who I saw in concert just a few weeks ago. He was so good, I thought I'd got to get an interview show with him. Luckily for me, and for you that are about to listen to it, he said yes. You're going to hear some great stories, you're going to hear some surprising stories, some surprising facts. One of them I'll tease you with right now is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. How that comes into the conversation, you'll have to wait and see. We get about 55 minutes into the hour, and we have a few technical problems. So what you will hear, there's a couple of edits near the end. But that doesn't spoil the great chat that you're about to hear as I spend 60 minutes with Brian Hogan. Right, Brian, I first saw you, a couple of weeks ago now at the Tivoli in Buckley. You were supporting the Choir Boys, and I believe that tour's, is it not long since finished?
Just back there, Monday just gone, yeah, so I finished now, two weeks, it was 9 dates altogether.
And what was the tour like?
It was brilliant, it was great, very generous bunch of people there. We're also, another band supporting was the Vargas Blues Band from Spain, well, they're actually from Latin America, and they kind of a couple of old blues guys from, playing with an English singer playing with them, Gaz, and we all kind of got on really nice. It was a nice tour, really was. You know, you're never really sure to expect who to expect or what to expect. You know, if someone throws a spanner in the works along the way, or if there's any prima donnas, which often happens, it could really be difficult. But actually, it was a breeze. Everyone was nice. Yeah.
Any tours lined up?
At the moment, no. We are hoping to do some stuff in Spain next year with the Vargas guys I was telling you about. We were talking about doing that and a couple of things around Ireland, but nothing has been committed to paper, shall we say. Mm-hmm. I suppose we're just planning out the new year and seeing where it takes us. We're off to Planet Rockstock Festival the weekend coming, and that's in South Wales, and then just some gigs at home in Ireland, and then we get Christmas over with, you know, and deal with the new year.
Well, people might have guessed from your accent, of course, you are Irish, and you grew up in Ireland, and you are the son of a preacher.
Indeed.
That's hence the name Preacher's Son then, yeah?
Yeah, he was what you would call a lay preacher, so he would have been like a Catholic, in the Catholic faith, but not an ordained kind of dude, but he would have taught religion, preached in schools about all, you know, all the stuff, and that's what he did. He was a musician. He had a number one album over here in 1974. His name was Larry Hogan. And it was produced by, what was his name now? The guy who did Riverdance. Come on, it's there somewhere.
It is. It's at the back of
my Michael Flatley, no. It's the... it'll come to me over this conversation. It'll come back to me for that. He had a folk band in the 60s called We Four, which were kind of successful in England and Ireland a little bit. They were kind of like a Peter, Paul and Mary vibe.
Yeah.
And so that's... he ended up preaching about Jesus and all that kind of stuff. That was his thing. So... I started playing in bands with him since I was 12, and so I was kind of cursed for the rest of my life, you know. family trade, you know.
So what were you listening to? What sort of music did you buy then, when you got to an age when you could buy music?
Well, now, I was the middle brother. I had an older brother and older sister, so I ended up inevitably listening to their collections. I suppose we were reared in the 70s. I remember vividly ABBA, for example. AC/DC. And I mean, but then I remember Rumours, Fleetwood Mac's Rumours being a big deal in the household. It was such a huge album, then my father was into the folk, not Irish folk now, but like, you know, Cat Stevens kind of folk, and Dylan, those kind of guys, and Gordon Lightfoot, I remember as well. But then when I got a bit more sentient to my own stuff, I was getting into some heavier music, but he wasn't really into me. He got a real problem with the whole devil worship thing. That you remember, I mean, you remember the late 70s, early 80s, it was all such a the backward.
Oh yeah, the back masking on them, yeah.
He really got a hard on for that, and I remember thinking at the time that it just, so overblown. I mean, we didn't have the mass media that we did now, so people who were really into their religion were really scared about that stuff. They really thought it was a shot across the bows. I think it's because there was a lot of youth culture where we're looking towards music that was that their parents didn't want, as usual. So that I remember asking, because he was a DJ over here for a while, and I remember asking him to get me an album, of some metal music and all that. I wanted AC/DC or something, I can't remember. And he came back with a Meatloaf album. Well, it was Ballad of Hell, which is a great album, but it wasn't really what I was looking for. So I had to subversively find my own albums here and there,
Never got to the stage where you had to hide any of your albums, did it?
No, I do remember, though, being about 12 or 13 up in the attic, blasting out The Soft Parade by The Doors. And there's one song, and he goes, "When I was back in seminary school, there was a petition that put forth that you could summon the Lord with prayer." And there's this, he's bellowing it out. And I remember my dad shouting up the stairs, "What the hell are you listening to?" So, and I kind of went, "Don't worry about it, But he was I tell you, the crux of it, I was just thinking of it today, because I was just given a Monty Python a DVD. When Life of Brian came out, my dad was a huge Monty Python fan, but he was in total conflict over the Life of Brian, because his beliefs, the whole scandal that was going on about it,
Oh,
and he
yeah.
was torn between two places. It's like it's that says it all, really. You know what I mean? He wanted to laugh, but he wasn't letting himself laugh at it, which I thought it was a bit of a shame. But that's how people are,
That's it. Because a lot of cinemas banned it in the UK, didn't they, when that came out?
It was banned in Ireland up until 10 years ago.
That's crazy.
Yeah, like that, and The Meaning of Life, and four other films had total bans in Ireland, or something like that. There's some statistics, and two of them Monty Python. And that's only up until 10 years ago, which it's just insane. But that's the cultural sort of stranglehold that we are just getting rid of now, I suppose, over here. With the
Yeah.
whole religious connotations and all, it's just it's small town politics,
So you grew, obviously you grew up with a very eclectic music background then. What was the first instrument you picked up, and why? Why was it that particular one as well?
Well, okay, I have my dad's original acoustic 11 guitar from the 60s,
Oh,
and I
nice.
remember that. It's lovely. There's another story with that, actually, because my wife, actually, I was hanging them on the wall up the stairwell. We got this old two up two down, like Carnation Street house, and this very sheer wooden staircase. And I was hanging them up on the wall, the nice guitars, and my wife accidentally knocked against it, and it fell down the stairs
Oh
into
no.
broke into about 60 pieces. And I got my luthier friend, who works with some lots of friends, and he put it back together, and it actually sounded better when he put it back together. Don't ask me how, it just did. But anyway, so that's the first instrument I remember. And then we used to myself and my brother used to drum along to my dad's album when it came out. It was on the radio all the time with Rulers and Coal Scuttle. And I definitely remember we just used to go bashing along to anything. And then my uncle had a bass, and I remember visiting that house, and I used to play his bass along to ABBA, just randomly, not knowing whether I kept used to ask, no, I'd be four or five, asking, "Is there bass in this song? Is there bass in this song?" Not realizing that generally there was, but so that'd be my earliest memories of instruments. And then, but there was always drums in the house. My father originally was a drummer, and my brother was a drummer, and but yeah, so those instruments. And then when my brother started forming bands, then I started forming bands, and then it was just instruments around all the time. But guitar, really, I suppose the acoustic guitar is the mainstay.
Yeah. It sounds like there wouldn't be a lot of silence in the house as you were growing up.
Well, I grew up, you have to understand, I grew up with a lot of, over here there was a thing called a charismatic renewal, which was a kind of hippie Christian community thing. So there'd be prayer meetings in my house and all that sort of thing when I was growing up. So you'd wake up and there'd be 10 people crashed out in the front room, you know. And we just kind of got used to this and all that thing. So there was always a bit of music. And in fairness, I have very, very fond memories of it all. Mostly, I think it was positive, and these things always are positively meant. And then, I think they eventually get melted by themselves, by humans, I think. Once you involve humans, it's going to go downhill. But no, I grew up with a lot of people, a lot of singing, a lot of folk masses, that kind of thing, you know.
So was music even then something that you thought that you wanted to do, as a career with your life?
Yeah, that my mother's an art teacher, so I was kind of I went down that road as well. I'm actually a trained animator. I did that for a couple of years, and so is either going to be one or the other. Yeah, I mean it's hard. So you go, you kind of watch. I remember my watching my father doing music and that sort of, and then, but I remember thinking as a kid, I'd love to do that, but I don't know how you'd make a living out of it, because he kind of made a living every now and then out of it, and I suppose that's what I'm doing now in a way. It's such a peak and trough kind of thing. Until you need to get to a different level before you start generating. I basically, for example, over here, I play with another three bands, and you kind of one band you hope is busy when the other isn't, that kind of thing, so. You find ways, yeah, you find ways. But music, I always wanted to be. I had a really high-powered animation job in the late 80s in Paris, and I gave it up because I wanted to play music, put
Excellent.
that
And just with the animation as well, what's this about this Oscar nomination?
Oh, yeah, so I play with a band called Kela, which are kind of a large sort of world music, traditional Irish music hybrid band. I've been with them like a long, long time, and we did collaborate on a soundtrack for a film called The Secret of Kells, which is an Irish animation movie that got shortlisted for an Oscar in 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And now the same company, we did another collaboration, and they're in the long list for an Oscar nomination again. So that's what that's about. Yeah,
Oh, nice.
we've done some soundtracks with this traditional band. You kind of when they're looking for a bit of the modern Irish slant and things, we get the call sometimes. Yeah, it's great. It's great. It's a lot of instrumental music, You think of things in a different way.
And you had a number one hit with alongside U2.
That's right.
Oh,
You're doing your homework, I see.
I did. I did. I had a look.
So I'm sure you've heard of the Dubliners.
Oh, God, yeah, definitely.
So the main singer of the Dubliners for a period of time was a guy called Ronnie Drew, who would have been like the king of Dublin. He was just like a guy who would he'd sing the telephone book, and you'd sit there aghast at his knowledge of the telephone book. He was a great singer. I got to meet him several times. A fantastic fella, and he was his wife had just died of cancer, and he's just been treated for cancer, and everyone kind of, and U2 got together with a songwriter to write a song for him, and ends up being about him. And then people got together, they wanted some trad involved, so they got us involved, and Shane McGowan and Sinéad O'Connor, Liam O'Mahony from the Hot House Flowers, and it was a lovely collaboration, and we just put the single together, and then yeah, it went to number one. So that's we got a number one. It was great playing with all those folks. You want to see in the green room backstage. It was like a session from hell. It was amazing.
I
Yeah, it was
just,
great.
yeah, I'm just trying to picture what it'd be like in the green room with all those names that you've just mentioned there. That's been
Well, it was,
crazy.
well, we had a trad session, and it's funny. Trad players will just sit down and play, and it's interesting. And I know that so from playing with trad people. But rock and rollers, they're not quite sure. It takes them a while to actually settle in and actually just sit in and play. Because it's funny enough, they don't do that all the time. You do as a kid, but once you get established, I had this very conversation with Adam Clayton. There goes a name dropped on the floor, but who, by the way, is a lovely, lovely fella, and He was saying it's the one thing that he misses is actually just arriving somewhere, sitting down and just jamming with someone. He said anytime they try to do that, it's like organizing a war or something, because there's PAs involved and all that. And I mean, he probably could if he wanted to, but I knew what he means. There was nothing casual about when you're kind of a rock star. So he was much admiration of it, because I mean, if you're a trad player and you play a bit of guitar, a drum, or a bit of a whistle, you can just sit down and make merry. We take it for granted.
All of the names you just mentioned there, and you've met so many people as well. Have you ever been starstruck when you've met anybody?
Brian May.
Oh, tell me about that.
Well, now I'm not a. I don't do autographs, and I don't necessarily bother people if I see them in the famous. It's not my thing, I'd like to admire them from afar. I just little, but Brian May, he is just a god. And I grew up like my tennis racket albums were the first Queen's Greatest Hits, and Morrison Hotel, and I was trying to in my mind. Sort of melange them together, as a kind of a genre, and but Brian May, I just think he's genius, and so we're in Heathrow with this trad band traveling somewhere, and I had the guitar in me back, and I looked down at the end of the check-in. I say it's bloody Brian May, and I'm there, and like I wouldn't normally bother, and I just said I have to do something, I have to do something. I never said it before, and so I had a little sketchbook I bring with me everywhere, and I went down and I asked him for an autograph, and I just like, and I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to say to him. I had no conversations for him, and so I walked down to him, and he had on a three-piece pinstripe suit, white clogs, and his hair was like a foot taller than he was, and I just went down and I said, "Harry, can I have your autograph?" "Oh yeah, great, great." He was asking what's on your back, and "Oh, it's a bass I'm playing." "Oh." I said, "I'm from Dublin." He said, "Oh, great place, great place." And then he started to tell me about his. I asked him how his band was going. This was after the Freddie Mercury tribute a couple of years, and I knew he was putting his new band together or something like that. But and I tell you what, he was actually a lovely gent. Not a bother on him saying hello to anyone. I just thought that was great,
It's
I
good,
have met
isn't
other people that I and classically that you shouldn't meet those you admire. So,
Ooh, yeah. It's always a pain when that happens, isn't it?
that's such a letdown. But people will always let you down, and then they'll surprise you.
You were great though. You were great at the TIFF. You
Thank you.
spent time with everybody and was friendly with everybody, which is, it's always good when we go to gigs there and people are really nice when we get to chat with them. So it's good.
Yeah. Well, I think for me, it's essential. I have to engage. We did the tour to engage with a new audience. It's a big undertaking for us to go over and tour in England. It just costs a lot of money, one way or the other, and you have to keep the band on the road, and so you kind of take a hit with it, if you know what I mean. But in order to get a new market, and that's so I have no problem going out there and talking to people, because it's as far as I'm concerned, that's what I'm doing on the stage anyway. You're communicating, so there's just different ways of it.
We got some new fans on the night. It's like my mate Ike who went with me. He bought the CD on the night after your gig had finished. I've bought it since, and
Right.
it's really good. It's to pick up on new bands that we didn't know about, and here we go. We've got this CD that we love to death now, so it's fantastic.
Ah, brilliant, brilliant. I'm delighted. It was Yeah, again, it was so that was the first night, and we didn't really know what to expect. And it off the people, I hadn't met any of the other bands before. And again, if there's any spanner in the works, could really ruin the tour for someone. You know what I mean? I've seen people being bullied. You know what I mean? In many ways, and there's airs and graces, and I think though everyone's long enough on the road to appreciate what being on the road's about. And it involves decorum and giving people space and stuff, So I think everyone adhered to that, and it's great. But it's lovely to me. I mean, I'd never been in all these places either before, so it was great,
And to be fair to you as well, there was a lot going on that night. And a lot of people didn't get into later when all the stuff was going on.
I
So
can tell.
there wasn't loads when you were on. What's it like when you get up on the stage and there's not too many people out in front of you. I mean, because you know, fair play to you, you were such a great front man, and the people that were there, you really got them going. You know, you just didn't hang your head. You played the place as though it was packed.
Well, it's a class one mistake to go out defeated. You cannot be defeated. Mm. You're in the wrong business. You have to. And I know that from, I've played with people before. I've been a backing musician for years, a bass player. And I made my another trade over here by backing people, you know, as a sort of session bass player. And I have seen people going on who are kind of prestigious or who've got some career and all that. But before they get on that stage, they're already defeated in their mind. There's a mental process, and it's a battle because, you have to go out there and I mean, it's a cliche, but you have to give your best shot every time. And we were over there to give our best shot. So, and I suppose as a philosophy, if I was in the audience and someone came out and it was just humdrum for whatever reason, I just wouldn't care. I'd ignore them. So I go out there thinking, all right, I'm here now. No one's going to ignore me. And I just, if I just get their attention and make what we do memorable and entertaining as well. Sometimes I talk too much. I'm sure you know the Billy Connolly story where he used to go out as a folk musician and ended up telling stories in between his banjo sets.
Yeah.
And then the banjo sets started getting shorter than the dialogue. And then the banjo just I haven't gone that far, but I've done some gigs where what the band members say, will you just shut up and play? You know, sometimes you get on a roll, you know, and you can rabbit on. But I do believe in entertaining those in front of you, if it's 5 or if it's 50, it's the same, I think.
Yeah, yeah. That's definitely the way to do it. Tell me about your first time on stage then. What was it like? Where was it? And what was it like? Your very first time on stage.
Yeah, I don't think. First time on stage, I guess I was around 12, and with my dad's band, and it was at some sort of school hall. He was giving a retreat, what we call a retreat, to some school for the week. I was just teaching about religion and all, and then they did a gig at the end of it. And I remember it was my first gig, and I remember going down, and we had to borrow everything because none of us had proper gear, and so it all got borrowed, and we arrived, and it was borrowed stuff. And it was, whatever way it worked out, there was 200 kids in the front, and it was like Beatlemania. They just started screaming once the curtains opened. And I don't remember playing a note, to be honest with you. I just remember being in shock. And But I'll never forget it, because the adrenaline was just like shooting out of my veins. And it was amazing, actually. I haven't thought about it in a while. And that definitely, it's the kick. Those big highs. That's why you get big lows with it as well, but you get those big highs. That's definitely that. I think that was in Wexford, south of Ireland here. But yeah, that's a very, very big memory in my head, yeah. That I haven't talked about in a while.
Do you ever get nervous before you go on stage?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Have you got any set thing that you do before each gig or not to maybe calm the nerves then?
Well, I like the nerves a bit, to be honest. I do a better gig if I'm nervous.
Yeah.
If I'm gigging for someone else or with the trad band I play with, I wouldn't get really nervous. You know, I get a bit of adrenaline, but with my stuff, because I know I'm up there selling it. And if you think about that a lot, it is kind of scary. It's kind of up to me to make or break it.
Yeah.
But I like that pressure because I think I learned when backing bands, you can be very complacent. You know, I'm a very competent musician. So I can back anyone, and I can just plod away, and that's fine. And maybe you're thinking about something else halfway through a song, or you know, think about someone else, or it doesn't matter. But you're not thinking about the gig. That often happens. So if I'm adrenalized and nervous before my own gig, which I need to be, I'm hyper focused, and then it's kind of it's up to me. Then, if you know what I mean, I don't leave it up to chance.
Yeah.
Are you with me? So I have to be as good as I can be.
Yeah.
That's what I have to, and so the nerves help with that because it's a constant adrenaline. Do I do anything? I do my vocal warm ups when I'm nervous, as well, and that helps me to kind of drone myself into some sort of place. And it's good though. I've no problem with the Nerves, as in I like the Nerves.
Yeah. Well, you've been a vocalist as well. Is there anything that you have to avoid while you're on tour as well? Because being on tour must take its strain on your vocal cords quite a bit.
Well, I don't smoke, so that's a big advantage. Yeah, I just think in moderation, from what I gather, and this tour, I really concentrated on you're singing night after night. See, my warm ups. I go to a coach occasionally, and I have a set of warm ups that really help. And if I don't do them, I really notice. If you know what I mean. And it's very easy to shoot out. I sing, I kind of try a very broad range when I'm singing, and sometimes I can really burn out the top of it if I'm not careful. So if I'm just roaring into the microphone and not consciously knowing where it comes from, if you know what I mean,
Yeah.
then I'm looking for trouble. You get about 3 gigs and then your voice starts stopping. It just start it stops working. So you need a consistent warm up technique, which I've only really started to do more regularly in the past year or so, and the difference has been huge. It just means that you're in good nick the next day. It's totally like it's just muscles. So you have to be aware of what you're doing to them. I'm lucky I don't smoke. I'd say smokers have a hard time of it.
Oh God, yeah, but they must do,
But
must do.
yeah, you find your ways. But to be honest with you, yeah, and I've been gigging long enough not to be on the piss every night.
Yeah.
If you're on the piss every night, it just it can you can't get very far out of it. You know what I mean? You just can't. Especially as you get older, you know the hang, as you know the hangovers don't get any better.
Oh God,
So
yeah, I can relate to that.
yeah. So I just relative health. It's very I find it's very hard to stay healthy on the road because you don't get to. You don't get to walk around much, or you don't get to exercise much. So you kind of, I suppose I try to conscious to not eat shit, you know,
Yeah.
which is hard because sometimes all you can find is some is shit. So, but that to me, I definitely know some touring. If you can find some decent food that doesn't sit in your stomach for 4 days, then you know, you'd be grand.
Yeah. I take it there must be quite a few stops like motorway service stations and so on when you.
Well, they've vastly improved now. I remember back in the 80s, all the little chefs and all that, and that was disastrous, expensive and disastrous, and it was just horrible, everything. But there's a lot of variety now. In you know, you can pick up a salad and things like that. That's you know, at least you have options. There's a lot more options now than there used to be.
Yeah.
So you just have to, I just think you just have to be not lazy about it, you know.
Right, we've gone through. You played with your dad. You were up on the stage. That was your first gig. How did you go from there to creating a band? What was your first time when you put a band together?
Well, I put a band together before that, actually, when I was about, well, maybe it's around the same time. I'm trying to think now. Maybe around the same time. I remember I was playing guitar, and then perhaps in the same year, because my brother had a band that were regularly rehearsing in the garage, and so I always obviously started jamming around with that, and then I put a band together with some couple of schoolmates. We had a couple of rehearsals. But we didn't go that far, you know. We broke up musical differences, you know, at 12, and then after that, I didn't really bother doing my own thing. I ended up, see, I got the job as the bass player because I was the runt, you know. It's the usual story, but as the usual story goes, I got all the work, you know. So I mean, I started getting professional gigs around the age 17, with a. I remember I got a country and western band because no one else wanted to play bass, so I was playing bass, and I got the gig. It was grand. I was getting paid at 17 years old. You know, I was just out of school, and I got you know $90 into my hand for playing half an hour somewhere. It was great, you know. So, and literally then, very I was a backing musician for years until I kind of. Maybe five, six. Well, I've been demoing on my own. I suppose that's what it was. And then the missus encouraged me to just make them a bit fancier. And then I decided, we said, I'll try some, maybe just try and put an album together. Just, and that was, that's coming up to 6 years ago, maybe. I started that. So I started compiling what I had. And then a year later, I ended up jamming with these musicians. I got them in as favor and then started putting a band together. Yeah, I suppose that's what it was. So about 4 years ago, really, that first album started. And then that's it. It took a long time. You know, you need to be the confidence and the want for it, you know. Whereas I was a musician who was always behind the singer, if you know what I mean. So it's just something, maybe it was a midlife crisis. Pre-midlife crisis. I always said my midlife crisis was I bought a Gretsch guitar and put a band around it.
That's not a bad thing to do.
Yeah, it was either that or Harley. The weather's terrible for Harley over here, so I don't know.
Go on tour with the band instead. Tell me about the recording of the album then. How did he get to get it
The
to get it?
recent one. So, well, it's there's no short story there. It's I started off and I had myself, the band was really myself and the drummer, who was this female lady, and Emily, and she, we were the kind of the duo, and we had people kind of guesting in. That was kind of like it was. And so we started a new album, and in that process, classically, we had a kind of a, she basically, long story short, she couldn't do it anymore, one way or the other. So that kind of scuppered me, because I had an album in the bag and she like had written four of the songs. And I'm there going, oh my God. So I couldn't use those songs, and money had already been spent. It was, and then I started doing some rewrites. I was trying to find other people to rewrite, and I ended up going to the producer we worked with, Mark Uccelli, who did Les Paul's last album, and got a Grammy for it. But he was great. So I flew over and did some extra stuff with him in New York. Came back to our people in London, who were the radio pluggers, if you like, and Tony and Scream. I mean, he's a great guy, but he liked one of the songs, and then he said, "They're bad." The rest of it, nah, mate, down here it. I suggest you go back in the studio. I'm going, oh my God. So, I mean, it's a classic, difficult second album personified, you know. And so I did. I hooked up with a couple of different writers and reshaped some of the old recordings, made some new ones. Ended up going, we went to a video award ceremony in Los Angeles, a small one, for our video that we had for the song Come On. And we won that. It was, you know, a small thing, but it was great. We decided to make a week in LA, we'd never been to before. And while I was over there, okay, it's all coming back to me now. We had been gotten in touch with via Sonic Bids by Jack Douglas, who produced John Lennon's last two albums and produced a lot of Aerosmith's albums. And he had gotten in touch on an online forum. He gave us a crit of our album and stuff previously, and was very charming and nice about it, and said, "Look, if you're ever over this side, give me a shout, and you know, let's see if we can do something." So lo and behold, there I was in LA, and I rang him up, or I emailed him, and he met up with me in Denny's. We had a meeting in Denny's, and lovely fella, just chat, chat, chat. What do you want to do? Blah, blah, blah. And he ended up facilitating me with this guy who's his assistant, called Warren Hewitt, who's the resident producer in in a studio in LA, and which Swing House Studios, excuse me, he'll kill me for that, but there's so many studios there. But anyway, in Swing House, and I hooked up with him. He'd done The Fray. I worked with them, and he'd produced co-produced the last Aerosmith album. He was kind of, he was in the rock and roll world of LA very much, and an English guy, and I met him, hooked up with him. We had a chat, and then over a period of time, we just did a deal, because I was thinking, I need some sort of magic to get what I have and make something of it to maximize what I can get out of it, both commercially and just sonically, and make it current. And these are the things you're trying to think, because I'm the record company as well. There's no one else there, so I have to sort of, I've done gone down the road so far. I need to make the best out of my investment, put it that way. So I ended up doing over there a couple of weeks recording with him and a friend of mine, Tanya, and we came back with an album, and which, again, by the end of it, you come out at the end of recording an album and you can't hear anything. You don't know what sounds good anymore. But needless to say, two of the tracks out of it, Come On and Jericho, which were the first singles we released, they were playlisted for weeks and weeks on Planet Rock Radio by Wyatt Wendell's Love It. So it worked, The gamble worked. I don't necessarily think you have to go to LA to make a great album, but I kind of knew what I was doing in the sense of trying to get a sound, I suppose,
Oh yeah. How would you, for people that haven't listened to it then, how would you describe the sound of the album?
Well, we try to call it swampy grit glam. It's a rock and roll thing, but it's also got a blues influence, it's kind of the sum of lots of influences, but it has a kind of a, I suppose, a swamp rock. I would like to have it like that. So it's a swampy rock, a blues kind of thing, And then from my vocal, there's a bit of Irishism in it, very subtle kind of end of things. But I'm as big a fan. I'm not just. It's not just a heavy thing. It's a. I'm as much into the Beatles as I am into any heavy group, It, the melody is important to me as well,
Oh yeah, I think the melody shows through in every one of these songs as well.
It's essential for me, It can't be just one thing or the other. I'm actually, if I had my carte blanche, I would make an album, and every song would be completely different from each other. But that's just the way my head thinks. So sometimes I have to just be pulled back and just make them relate to each other, until you get incredibly famous, then you do what the bloody hell you want, But
Have you got any sort of process that you go through when you're writing a song? Or does it just, each song comes in different ways, is written in a different way?
it can come differently. A good few songs on this came with a riff, busting out with the amp up loud and the guitar just chunking away, and you get a kind of a figure on the guitar that just feels right, and it's a good kind of, it's almost like a its own little chorus in a way or something. And then I try to, what I do recently, I know, is I can get a riff down, and then I kind of hum a melody over it, or phonetically say some things, and then just go back and back and work on it. Sometimes it comes quicker than other times, What I need to work on, though, is that is to, I try it from the other end, where you get the words going, and then it's a totally different process for me. I've been so music bound, if you know what I mean. Whereas the singer songwriters classically have all the words, and then they need to get music to it. But I said I have no one process that has worked better than others, except trying to get a riff. I've been in an instrumental band for so many years. I've no problem writing music and attaching one piece to the other or finding ways. It's just getting a lyrical content that isn't meandering. That's something I'm still working on. I need to get better with my words, better storyteller. I'd like to be a better storyteller, because some of the stuff I do is probably a little bit not random, but doesn't see. I can't even find the word I'm looking for now. But so it's a good example. But I need to maybe need to study the thesaurus a bit better. No, I think just less sporadic. Song structure. I mean, I always I might write. If you're a writer, just write. So I should be up in my little attic song room for half the day writing. Even if I'm writing crap, I'll be writing. So that's, I suppose it's putting your money where your mouth is, really, when it comes to that kind of thing. I could definitely, there's definitely room for improvement, put it that way.
Do you have any favourites on the album then? I know as, people that, as fans who buy the album, we always pick favourites out. Do you have favourites on it?
There's one song called Angel, which is about a very good friend of mine, and it's a personal story of advice to someone, And I think I'm most happy with that in the sense of it's. I remember getting the first mix back from LA, and it was just like, it was kind of belligerent, not belligerent, it was just like four to the floor, very straightforward. And I freaked out, and I ended up having a conversation with the producer, and we had talked. And anyway, my whole idea was that it was as much Beatles as it was kind of a power song, And that as a song and a structure and musically, I think I'm probably the happiest with that song because it was like the picture I had in my head. And it was the closest I came to it out of all the songs. Sometimes you imagine these things, and it just doesn't come as you would imagine, which can be a good thing. But that one in particular, I think Angel, it sticks out for me. Yeah.
You mentioned as well earlier, when you met, you saw Brian May and you said you had your notebook with you. So you carry this notebook around with you all the time. Is that for like any song ideas, anything lyrically or anything like that? You just jot it down?
It used to be. I used to write the poems, but. And also just to drawings because I try to keep myself drawing. To be honest with you, now it's the voice memo on my iPhone is the best tool I've ever had. So I'd be randomly in the car driving somewhere, and then I just get this kind of you start humming something to yourself, and it's one of those little magic things. I have a whole bank of all these like 2 seconds of a little melody, and they probably stay there for years. But it's a great way to get it down in the moment. But the notebook's not anymore. I have to force myself because I have to get back into. I've got a couple of drawing projects, illustration projects that I need to get done, and so the only way to do that is keep a book with you at all times. But you just kind of have to get the discipline of that going. I'm a, as usual, like most men, I'm a terrible procrastinator. If I get paid to think, I'll be a rich man.
Is there any story behind the title of the last album, 10 Stories Tall, as well?
There was a song I had. I want to, it was just a play of words, I suppose. Because obviously there isn't 10 songs on it. There's 12. Ha ha ha! See how clever I am. No, it was a lyric in one in a song that never made the album. But it was basically I wanted to make a story. I was just playing with the word story. So I wanted to make a story that was 10 stories tall. So it was a kind of a romantic notion, sort of an ode to a lady. I wanted to make our story 10 stories tall. So it was just a play with those kind of words. But it just had a nice 10 stories tall. I suppose it just sometimes it doesn't have to make sense. It sounds right. Do you know what I mean? It's a good phonetic, and I think sometimes in songwritings that seems to be a good thing as well. It's something that you like saying. Regardless of it, it hadn't make too much sense, but that's the sense is that I'm just playing with words, to be honest with
And how was this album? So people now hopefully are going to go out and buy this. They're going to buy 10 Stories Tall.
you.
So then they'll want to listen to more by you. So we're going to go into the back catalogue, and we go 2010, Love, Life and Limb. What can they expect from that album? Does it differ greatly? Is there big change in style? Because I'll be honest with you, Brian, I haven't heard that album yet.
Right. Well, it's less. It's a lot more. It's less. It's a lot less produced. I kind of produced it, and then I got the great Dave Bascombe mixed it for me, who's done Depeche Mode and Kylie Minogue and Korn and a couple other bands. It's just a great radio mixer, and he mixed it, but I kind of produced it. And that I'd be at fault because I was certainly not making a commercial album at all. So like the songs on there that are 6.5 minutes long, which is nothing wrong with that, but they don't necessarily need to be, if you know what I mean. There was less self-editing than I would do now, but I think there's some great music on it, and it's a great listen. I'm very proud of it. I got some, I got strings on it, I got a bit of brass on it. It's I kind of threw the kitchen sink at it because it was the first solo album, you know, or the first of this project. So classically, every idea you've been waiting for years to do is going to be on that album, and believe me, it is. There's 10 kitchen sinks on that album, but I think it's great. I'm very proud of it, you know. I suppose you just have to listen to it and see what you think.
I will do. I definitely will do. Definitely. It must be frustrating now, though. You know, we're in the digital age and all this file sharing and album sales, like not being what they used to be. Is there any incentive for you as an artist to go, you know, why should I put an album together if, you know, one person's going to buy it and then he's just going to share it with thousands of others?
It's interesting. I was watching there's a film, and I saw it yesterday. I can't remember the name of it, but it's about do you know the band 30 Seconds to Mars? So they brought out a film, was it last year, I think, based on they were being sued by EMI. They were selling 2 million copies of their album worldwide, and they were doing very well. And then EMI went through this whole shift and was bought out by some guy. They were being sued for $30 million,
Whoa.
and they ha and to this day, it says at the end of the film, they haven't even been paid any royalties for any of their albums at all. And it was the whole process, but in this film, it goes on about that. It's the whole file sharing, and people expect it for nothing now. And some musician was saying, you know, that you pay more for a coffee than you do for a body of work that you've spent your guts for a year on, you know. It seems crazy. I can only be positive in the sense it's just technology. You know, the new standards have to be set up. You have to find new ways. It's very frustrating, but I don't think it's realistically any more frustrating than it's a double-edged sword. The ocean is free to swim in, but there's more people swimming in it. In a way, like I remember the days where you'd struggle to try and get anything recorded. Now I can record a whole album in my attic to a standard that is as good as many things, you know. So that changes, but that means anyone can, you know. It's an argument that's gone round and round and round. The record companies don't know what to do. People are self-releasing, which is great, but it's flooding the world. But I don't know. You find ways. I have no solution to it, apart from just trying to be bloody good, you know. But that's what I mean. And I do think in the show, you're doing these shows in England, to new audiences. All I say to myself is sell the bloody thing, you know. Go out there and sell it here and now, you know. That's all I can do about that, because I can't have a million, I don't have a million followers on Facebook or Twitter, do you know what I mean? Which is really the demographics are all about these your stats, you know. I can't compete with some 18-year-old guys who have a million fans because it's their generation and that's the way it works. You know what I mean? It's frustrating because part of you're constantly forcing yourself to do the social media thing, which is fine, but it's are you pissing against the wall? You know what I mean? You can't compete with One Direction, you know. So don't try to. You just have to be bloody good and find your own little path. In a philosophical way, I suppose, you do it until you can't, you know. And I'm still doing it somehow, you know. I don't mean that in a bad way. Like I always said to any young musician, you do this or you don't do this. Because it's too hard if you're expecting quick rewards or that they aren't there. You know, you gotta do it because you love doing it, because it's too bloody hard otherwise. And there's no bloody money in it.
Yeah, I think it shows though. I think people can pick up, can't they, on those that you can see when somebody has got a passion for what they're doing, and those that are just, you know, just doing it for the, you know, just for the hell of it.
But that's what I'm saying. That's why that's why I try so hard to entertain people, because you got it. People aren't foolish, and look, I'm a believer that it is show business, you know what I mean? Even if you're a serious songwriter, serious sort of heavy stuff, you still got to bring and engage people, you know. That's just my philosophy. I got that from my dad, you know. You got to get the person, make them remember what you're trying to say to them in a way, you know. And also, you got to convince yourself first, you know.
Yeah.
I got great advice off a songwriter once. He saw me, I think it was probably a bit jarred, and we were in a session, and I was singing some cover or something like that. And he said, "I saw you halfway through that song, and you lost interest in what you were doing." And he said, "You should never do that." And he says, "If that ever happens, close your eyes and convince yourself." And because if you can't convince yourself, you can't convince anyone. It's as simple as that. Because people are not stupid. They might know why they're not interested anymore, or they're not looking over there, but they're not just going to look at you bored or not interested. You know what I mean? So
Yeah.
those are the important things. That's what I mean. It's a brave new world out there, and again, it's a lot to be lucky, you know. But think about it. I mean, rock and roll is old now, as we know. It's not a new thing anymore. So it's almost twice the battle, but it's still the same competition trying to get it out there and trying to get people to like it. Like, I really admire the Choir Boys, because they give a great they give great show. You know what I mean? They're a
Yeah.
very entertaining band, and they have loyal people there who just love them. And I cannot deny them any of that. I think they're just pros, and that's what it's about, you know. And you know, they're not trying to. They're not pretending to be anything other than what they are. And I admire that because it means they will exist, and they do exist. And that's why they're getting good. They're good, loyal followers, you know. So that's lessons for me to learn, you know. But you got to be 100% all the time. I suppose. So what was? Have we veered away from the question? I mean, this is about digital and all that. I don't know. I have an iPod that has all my albums on it. I think that's deadly. You know what I mean? Mark, the guitarist, is a vinyl nut, but and I've got my old vinyl, but I haven't bothered to get a vinyl player. I have nowhere to put it at the moment. But it's just a medium, you know. But I think people will always want music. I suppose it's a matter of how they approach buying it and how artists get paid. I suppose that's what the problem is, really.
Yeah, it's
The
like
whole.
even going back years ago, I remember it was like home taping is killing music, and
Yeah.
they thought that was the end of it then, didn't they?
They did, yeah, because people were making mixtapes and blah blah blah, but no one saw it coming as it did, you know. It's funny because I got half my mates who are regularly on Spotify, and what they're doing is listening to music very quickly. I did the gig. I'm constantly fascinated by, like, I remember a couple of gigs. I meet someone before the gig, and they said, "Oh yeah, I just heard you 10 minutes ago on Spotify. Just checking out what you're on." And I found that amazing, actually. But there's the other side of me, which goes the whole thing about Spotify pays so little towards, you know, that again, it's and apparently they're changing that. But apparently Blurred Lines earned $240,000 that year that it went ballistic from Spotify, and like that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
It really doesn't. Like that, it's almost, I can't say, I don't know if it's criminal, but it's like, and I suppose people now, there's a generation now who will expect not to pay for music. And
Yeah.
that's weird. So I don't know where they expect it's going to come from, or how they people can afford to make it if you can't get paid for it, you know. So that has to change somewhere. So someone will get, but people will want music. I know that. I think, I suppose the way I'm thinking is that in my world, I would if I had the ideal world, I'd put on a different show. I'd have a kind of a cabaret show, a gig. I'd have a stripper, like the old days, and then I'd have a cookery exhibition, and then a comedian, and then have a band, and then something else. And so you make a kind of a spectacle, I suppose, you know. I'm just conscious of making a show, because to be honest with you, even we were touring and there was three bands. It's a lot to take on three bands in a row. Do you know what I mean? It's a lot for your head to take on.
Yeah.
So in my world now, I'd mess it up a bit, you know, but I don't know if that's ever going to happen. But why not?
I'd buy a ticket to it. You've sold
Yeah.
that show to me straight away.
An exhibition of how to make ice cream, you know.
Yeah.
And then some sort of slutty dancing, you know. And you incorporate the two of them because you can mix it in there, the ice cream, slutty dancing. You know,
Yeah.
I can see that, yeah.
That's it. One naturally follows the other. That's all. One last question for you before we're sort of slowly running out of time, unfortunately. You're on about, like, you always put all the energy into your performance and everything.
Yeah.
What bands have you really enjoyed watching in the past that have done the same? But it's always lots of energy in that. Which bands have you enjoyed for that?
I had to think about that now.
Because you must have, do you get the chance to see many bands? That's the thing with you being out on the road quite a bit as well.
Well,
Do
I
you
do. I've seen a lot of diverse bands. I played a lot of world music festivals with this other band, so I get to see all the ethnic stuff as well, which is great. And I suppose it depends on someone. Beck. I always
Oh,
admire
yeah.
Beck. I've seen him several times, and he gives great. The producer of my father's album was Bill Whelan, who's the guy. That's
Nice.
there we go. Knew I'd remember along the conversation. My wife says I have a head like a string vest. You know, nothing stays in there except fish.
Let me think, because when I'm just thinking for edit, I'll do an edit and
Okay, so you want some interesting facts?
yes, go on.
I used to animate Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Get away.
No, that's the
Oh.
truth. And I used to work with Disney, and I was animating on DuckTales the movie.
Yeah.
Other interesting facts: I played with the Cheeky Girls
Ooh.
once.
Were they cheeky?
No, they were scary. And I played with George Hamilton IV, who just died. As in,
Wow.
do you remember the country singer?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I played with him once. I was in a Christian festival with my father. We were kids, and he needed a backing band. And at the time, I remember because he had a big TV show on a Sunday. I don't know if you remember that back in
I do,
a million years ago.
yeah.
And he was just this big kind of TV country and western guy. He had a whole three-piece suit and was all denim. It's hilarious, but he was a polite, tall Texan kind of guy, you know. So there's a couple of interesting facts there.
That's good. What do you think of the new Mutant Turtle film then? Have you seen it? The
It
CG heavy
looks
one.
great because of the effects, but I liked one scene in it. I went with my daughter, myself and my daughter. She's 10, and we go to all the new movies, which is great because I get to check out all the stuff I really want to go
Oh
see.
yeah, it's a great excuse, isn't
Yeah,
it?
but it was awful. Apart from there was I don't know there was one scene in the lift I thought was brilliant. Have you seen it yourself?
I haven't, no, I do want to watch it
Okay.
though.
Well, go watch it. It's worth it. Effects wise, it's amazing because they can do anything now.
Yeah.
So it looked fantastic. So great art direction. Story wise, absolutely awful. I don't understand why it was so bad. Like they had so much. Now I can't speak because the cartoons that I mentioned were awful as well, but the actual original comics and all were brilliant and very revolutionary at the time, because they were so different. But I thought it was going to be more like that, but no,
Oh.
it's nonsense.
Oh.
But
I'll definitely watch it though. I'll have to watch
oh
it.
no, it's worth a watch. And
Yeah.
just check for the scene in the lift is brilliant. You'll
Oh.
see what it
I'll keep that in mind now. I'll watch out for a lift, see.
is.
Oh, we talked about social media and everything. What's the best way that people can find and follow you online,
Well,
Brian?
Facebook is the most, and then we do Twitter. I'm trying my hardest to kind of keep up, and moving to other side of room, hashtag door. It's I'm trying, but Facebook generally is the most, I suppose, straightforward way. And then preachersun.com. What else? Instagram, I stick stuff up. I kind of. It's a funny it's a funny way to communicate in many ways, but that's what everyone does. So, but yeah, I suppose that's yeah. I can't think of anything else really. I'm sure there's other things I've missed,
Well, if
but
there are, I'll put them all up. They'll all be in the podcast notes for this episode. So,
brilliant. Well, on bridgeson.com, it has links to everything we have,
yeah.
so that and it has all info. So it's usually the best to kind of get something out of it, you know.
I know it's only days after the last tour finished, but is there any hope of seeing you back in Buckley at the Tivoli for again coming over at any point in the near future or
We're
far
gonna
future
try.
even?
It's literally what we will work on the next tour and see what kind of we can do. Because at the moment, the best way for us is to hook on with another bigger band who has a kind of a following. Because we're just scratching on the surface in England, really. You know, we're dipping over. It's close enough to us, but it's also just trying to. We haven't quite running our own, been running our own gigs over there. We've done a couple in London, but it's a real challenge, you know. The way we see it, England has more people.
Yeah, that's true.
And so the chances are we'll probably get more people coming to the gig.
Yeah.
So we're just chipping away. We've had a bit of luck with the Planet Rock Radio, and yeah, we'd love to. It was a great venue. I'm dying to see the upstairs.
Yeah, you say upstairs at the Tiv. Is it, you mean the haunted bit? Is that the one?
Yes, well, the proprietor there, I can't remember her name, which lovely lady, was giving me the whole history of it, and that you know, it hadn't been basically touched since the fire and all that, and it was haunted and all that. That's fascinating.
Oh yeah,
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd fancy staying the full night there though. That'd be a
It'd
bit of a test, I think, to do that.
be a challenge, all right, yeah, wouldn't
Oh God, yeah, it would be good. Well, Brian, I've got to say thank you for giving me your time today.
You're
I've
very welcome, David. I appreciate you're doing it. You know, I'm sure we can tell everyone it's taken weeks to organize. Cancellation after cancellation, and the last one, I was out of my mind with the flu 2 days ago, and it didn't happen. But you know, we are here now.
We are. I'm glad you are. And hope, well, say, hopefully, you're going to get across if you ever come back and you're in the North Wales area. I'll be there, in a heartbeat. And I recommend, everybody that's listening to this, if you see Preacher's Son anywhere, or go and see them. You won't regret it, that's for sure.
Well, we do our best. We literally, it won't be from lack of trying. It's you know, we are in a different country, but it's I smell a market over there, and I'm going to chase it.
You follow that smell all the way
Oh,
here.
well, yes, I have big nostrils, and the fumes are coming up them, and I shall endeavor to find the source of these fumes.
Good.
And,
Hopefully it's a very sweet smell at the end of it for you.
yeah.
All right, Brian, thank you so much. And
David, you're very welcome. Yeah.
all right, and hopefully we'll talk again soon, and I'll see you soon.
Yes, indeed. And I say hello to all who are listening. And preachison.com, and you know, onwards and upwards.
Definitely. And there we are. Once again, the alarm goes off. The episode is finished all too quickly. I'd like to thank Brian for joining me. Make sure that you all visit preachersson.com. You can like the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/preachersonofficial. And give them a follow on Twitter too, which is @preachersson_IE. While you're following them and keeping up to date with everything that you do, go on to iTunes or to Amazon, buy the CD of 10 Stories Tall. You won't regret it. Have a listen to it while you're keeping up with all of the news. The next episode, I'll be joined for the monthly entertainment show with Chris and Ramrod, and there's some more surprise interviews lined up for you coming at you very soon as well. So once again, thank you to Brian. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back with you all very soon.